Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do a writer's own experiences contribute to telling other people's stories? And what does it take to explore one's own life through writing? Alexandra Fuller wrote novel after novel in her early writing career, but her work attracted little attention until she took a bold step into nonfiction and wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. The best-selling memoir told the story of Fuller's childhood in Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe, at a time when white settlers battled native Africans for control of the government. Life there was so dangerous that by the age of six, Fuller and her sister were each taught to clean and load semi-automatic weapons and shoot to kill. In her next memoir, Scribbling the Cat, Fuller returned to southern Africa from her home in Wyoming to travel with a former soldier and try to make sense as an adult of the conflict she lived through as a child. Her latest book was published last year and tells not her own story, but that of Colton H. Bryant, an oil worker who fell to his death in a 2006 rig accident. She's in town to speak tonight at Arts and Letters Live, which will take place at the Dallas Museum of Art, and we are delighted to have her here in studio. Alexandra, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
You have said that you started writing sort of around your real life and those events, and it never worked as well as nonfiction. Why do you think that you didn't try to write it straight out the first time?
I think it would have been like jumping off a cliff without a parachute, sort of digging deep into really my own story, but the story of my people and the people who raised me. I was 24 and I'd moved to this country from Africa, from Zambia, actually, by then. And what was sort of initially very striking was people would say, well, that's a neat accent. Where are you from? And I would start telling them and their eyes would glaze over. And I realized that the kind of weight of my story it was numbing for people. And not only that, I think there were so many preconceptions about, well, you're white, you're African, you're from Southern Africa. And so people immediately popped to apartheid and everything that was. And I found myself layering expediency on top of, you know, what was really the truth, which was quite brutal. And I thought, well, maybe, and I wanted to write. I'd always wanted to write. I thought, well, maybe if I just fictionalize it, smooth things over. And so I wrote these sort of fictionalized versions of my life where you had this sort of quite eccentric mother and a taciturn father and a bullying older sister and then this lovely younger child who dies tragically three quarters of the way through the book and then everyone wishes they'd be nicer to her. And they were roundly rejected. And really, I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, I think out of a place of assuming it would never, ever see the light of day, more to write the story that was just boiling up in me.
It has to be terrifying, though, when a story that you thought might never see the light of day then goes national and international and is this huge hit, and then suddenly your story belongs to everyone.
It is, and I think, you know, I think the key to what, you know, the answer is right in what you said. The story does belong to everyone. And I think once you, it took me years, but once you understand that piece of it, that yes, this was my story, but it belongs to the reader every bit as much as it belongs to me. The ownership goes away, the ego goes out of it, and it deflates the sense of pain because it deflates the sense of ownership.
Your parents were and are farmers, which is automatically sort of a tough life for a kid living anywhere in the world. And then there was this element of violence that was sort of always around, not only from human beings, but even nature was sort of a violent place where you grew up. What did comfort and safety mean to you when you were a kid?
Wow, that's a great question. I think I went into the world of literature for that. No one's ever asked me that before. I think, looking back, and in fact, even now, I find a great deal of comfort and a great deal of sort of, haven, I think, in other people's worlds. And so I retreated into the world of literature. And as a child, that was very much these sort of comfortable Beatrix Potter sort of English narratives where everything was comfortable and clean and tea time was at the same time every day. And you had these sort of quite regular British lives because growing up, even in the middle of Africa, we had, my father is English and my mother had a very British sensibility, which is to say she's not at all English, but thinks she is. And so, so that I think provided comfort. It was the world of the The unreal.
It had to be strange, though, as a kid when you read this, and it felt like maybe the rest of the world was that way, and you were in a place that was so different.
I think that it took me years to understand. But, you know, part of the problem of growing up in Rhodesia, as it was then called, was the propaganda machine insisted on the Rhodesian world viewpoint, which was that if you were white, you were superior to everyone else, and that we were fighting this righteous war against, you know, communist insurgency, etc. But then the rest of the world was so inconvenient, because this was only true in Rhodesia in the 1970s. It wasn't true of the greater world in general, who were growing out their hair and you know, crying for peace and for justice and for environmental improvements and that kind of thing. And so Rhodesia just ended up being sort of this ridiculous teapot floating around and nothing. And in school, our history, our geography, and practically everything else ended at our borders. Hmm. And so the rest of the world just sort of dropped away. And incredibly, it wasn't until I was a teenager that I actually put the rest of Africa onto a map around Zimbabwe and then added on the world. And so it was, you know, for me, the rest of the world was a concept, but it wasn't real.
How old were you when you first went to school with kids who were not white?
11, mm-hmm. At Independence. I was at a government school, and I think to the great sort of shock of people like my mother, who just sort of assumed that her passion would mean that Rhodesia would be forever white run, Independence came, and overnight equality sort of ensued, and that, that's way too broad, but a kind of equality ensued, which included the fact that all schools were open to children of all races, which was a brilliant place to start. It ended up being the most fabulous gift, because I was at an age, 11, 12, you know, just as you're sort of going through a period of questioning yourself and change yourself, and suddenly my entire world changed, did a complete 180. And I could really see everything that I'd been taught up until the age of 11 for the big, huge lie that it was. Very often people who sort of speak in prejudice and have sort of hardline points of view say, well, that's just the way I was raised. I was raised to believe X, therefore that's true. Well, I was raised to believe that, you know, being white made me racially superior and that God was on my side because I was white and all this other nonsense. Being at school, sharing the bed next door with people, who were black, who had all these lies told about them, showed that startling lie to me in a way that, I think was a great gift.
It has to be hard. I mean, that's an age, as you said, when you're starting to question everything that you're told and who you are. But to have to redefine yourself at the age of 11 or 12 from having believed that it was your birthright to be superior because your skin was white. And then you also have to look at your parents and their beliefs in a different way. How did you seem to still have a good relationship with them. How did you manage that?
I don't know that I did. I mean, I think manage is a strong word for the chaos that sort of ensued in your head. But the great thing about boarding schools, you have to sort of soldier on. And I think that was why I had to write Scribbling the Cat, the sort of exploration into the war, which was that for us, the war just ended. And then there was no really deep exploration. There was no public discourse about what had happened.
No Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
No attempt at that. The war was just over. And so those people who had cherished this idea of themselves from whatever side were now left to kind of suppress that idea of themselves. And I think it caused a lot of resentment. It caused a lot of kind of sideways violence, you know. After the war, an awful lot of the soldiers from both sides, the trauma was incredible, but it was suppressed. So below the surface, there was a lot of domestic violence, a lot of alcoholism. A lot of people became born again Christians. You know, this kind of bubbling over of emotions into other places. So I'm not sure I ever sort of adequately addressed it in the way that you suggest until probably writing Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, beginning to put it down on paper, was the beginning of addressing it. Everyone always says, well, isn't it very cathartic to write a memoir? But it's, I discovered the opposite. I've found actually putting it on paper like that, for what it was, phenomenally painful.
Well, it crystallizes things that maybe were just amorphous before.
And I think it forces you to address them. And I'm glad I did, because I think there's a danger of one's personality being formed out of the things that we suppress. And so, you know, your kind of most neurotic self is formed out of the things that you choose to ignore about yourself. Mm. And in my case, that would have been completely tragic and horrendous. You know, the amount of violence, the racism, the disregard for, you know, equality and justice. I think suppressing traits like that, that's not something you want to carry around in you subconsciously.
This guy that you followed in or traveled around with in Scribbling the Cat, Kay, is a fascinating character because he is hard to love and impossible to completely hate. And what's interesting about him, I think, is that although clearly there are a lot of things he stands for that are hard to understand, I think there's also a sense that there's a lot more nuance in race relations then and now than I think Americans imagine white colonialism in Africa as being very, pardon the expression, black and white. And it's not always.
Well, I think that's the same of race relations in the southern U.S., that if you live up in the northern part of the U.S., you assume it's black and white. Well, it's not like that when you get down there. It isn't the KKK versus, you know, civil rights. It's something often a lot more gray. Of course, the, you know, horrendous hate crimes and the horrendous extremes get attention. But I think that's what was so complicated as well about sort of the politics of growing up in southern Rhodesia, you know, Zimbabwe, Zambia, is that most people operate in a place of gray, not black and white. And so it's hard to pick sides. It's hard to say, well, this is completely wrong, or this is completely right. One of the questions that I keep getting now since Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, has sort of gone on a 9-year tirade against his own people is, well, wasn't it better under Ian Smith, who was the prime minister under, you know, white-run Rhodesia? I don't think you can say there's a moral equivalency. One isn't better or worse than the other. Both support an elitist regime that ignores the rights of the majority. And both are you destined to end in a kind of violent failure sooner or later.
How would you characterize the biggest failings of the West in dealing with a figure like Mugabe?
I think they allowed their own queasy inability to look at their own race relations to enter into Mugabe's very astute way that he played the Western politicians. So when Mugabe said, this is because of the British and this is because of, you know, white farmers, it was a complete red herring. I mean, really, it's hardly as if a handful of whites remaining in Zimbabwe can possibly dictate the course of that country's history. But I think that the West, having not dealt adequately with their own relationships, were unable to see what Mugabe was doing for what it was, which was pure and simple violence against his own people, until it was too late.
Alexandra Fuller is here. She's the author of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, Scribbling the Cat, and The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. She's in town to speak at an Arts and Letters Live event this evening at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can find information about that at dallasmuseumofart.org or on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest guest this hour is writer Alexandra Fuller, who is in town for an Arts and Letters live event at the Dallas Museum of Art this evening. You can find information at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Bill who says, Robert Mugabe is widely regarded to be a dictator, presiding over the worst inflation and human rights abuses. The country is no longer a breadbasket. Do you feel any hope about the future there under the present coalition government?
I think that the biggest tragedy was the coalition because it gave legitimacy to Mugabe, who clearly stole that election. Instead of saying, no, look, you stole the election, we need to take a deep breath and do this all over again so that we have a legitimate government going in. Instead, they patched together this coalition, and so the bully won. Mugabe, you know, played chicken with the country, and we ducked out of the way. It was too terrifying to think what would happen if he was challenged again. But you let this incredibly bad-tempered, incredibly vile man steal an election. Who now is going to want to truly invest in a sustainable way in the country when he's still at the helm? I think the greatest example of how to go forward was Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who won the elections in Liberia in 2005, November 2005. Previous to that, everyone had begged her to join forces with Charles Taylor, have a coalition government with Charles Taylor, who had stolen the elections before that. And Sirleaf said, no, he stole the elections and I will not join in and legitimize his government. She was widely pressured to do so, but she refused to and led to more misery. It most certainly did. But then when she came to power in 2005, it was a legitimate election. The people of Liberia got up behind her in a way that was forceful and undeniable. And she was able to go forward with a fresh mandate. And I feel that above all, what we need in African politics is honesty, credibility. We can't just say, well, this is better than the alternative. We need to have the best alternative possible.
It seems like there are a growing number of Americans who are really interested in Africa, but there are sort of two standard portrayals. There's the romanticized Africa and there's the demonized Africa. Why do you think that continent is so susceptible to looking at things from only one view or the other, and people have such a hard time expressing everything about it?
Well, I think that it forces the viewer to explore their own demons in a way that's extremely uncomfortable. Scribbling the Cat, you know, Journey into Mozambique with the Soldier, was a sort of doomed idea from a literary point of view, at least if you're hoping to win any popularity contests, because it really is an exploration into this kind of, you know, complicated world where you have a white African soldier who has committed horrendous crimes in the name of his belief. You have a very questionable, you know, protagonist, the author myself, going ahead and sort of digging through this quite murky, horrible past and getting up to her elbows and sort of blood and things that I really had no way of being able to control. I think Africa really, if you go there, I mean, I'm not going to speak of the whole continent, certainly the places that I've experienced. It's very hard to sit on your sort of moral high horse and stay on it. You might ride into Africa on your moral high horse, but you're going to come out leading a donkey, I think. It's just very hard to, I mean, I think Scribbling the Cat's full of those sorts of examples. There's a passage where Kay and I are driving up from Zimbabwe to Mozambique. He's just divulged this horrendous thing that he did in the war and then decides to go for sort of a walkabout to clear his mind. And I'm left sort of sitting by the truck waiting for him to come back. And some children arrive that are clearly starving. And they want potato chips and cigarettes from me. And they're, you know, under 14. Now, what I write in the book is that, you know, I hope no one in sitting in Wyoming feeding my children potato chips and cigarettes. But how do you say no to these children who had nothing? You know, I'm sitting there smoking a cigarette and having potato chips. I think your the sort of rules that you go by in a safe world no longer apply. And I think we're all precariously close to that kind of uncivilized place, which is why it makes it so hard for us when we go there. We need to see it in black and white. We couldn't bear for it to be that shade of gray. That would make us all culpable, I think.
Is it ever hard to reconcile how different your children's childhood is being raised in this country as Americans from the one that you experienced? And do you ever think that there's a sort of separation between you and them that you can't completely bridge?
Definitely. I mean, my 16-year-old is so sick of me sort of saying, well, you know, when I was a child, et cetera, et cetera. You can't do that. It's unfair and it's, you know, and she'll look at me and go, you're right. I am not you. This is not your childhood. And she sort of really brings me up to face, why would I even want anyone to have the childhood I had? I'm grateful I had it because I think it, you know, it made me sort of the person I am. But why would I wish that on anyone else? I think that I certainly insist on my children having a certain world view that maybe other parents wouldn't, just because of where I grew up. So we don't have television. They have to volunteer somewhere. You know, it's anything sort of good parents do anyway. But I think it comes from me, from a sort of anxiety that they'd be too comfortable with a sort of consumer society.
Well, it is interesting. You know, I think about, you know, raising middle-class American kids, we are almost obsessed with safety. They've got helmets and they've got special straps and protectors and things like that. You were handling a gun at six, and there was no mistaking what it was for. Your dad says, because if your mom and I are wounded or killed, you and your sister are going to have to defend yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Does that almost feel unreal to you now, or is it something that you can't make feel unreal?
You know, I think I lived so much before I was 20, 21, and really in a way does feel like a separate life. Like I stepped off a boat. Doesn't make the boat unreal, doesn't make that existence unreal, doesn't make, I think, the personality formed out of that unreal. But in a way, the boat left the shore. And the further away it gets, it's a greater and greater distance for me to get back there. I was recently home to visit my parents who live in the Zambezi Valley. And, you know, when I'm back there, I remember quite quickly what my childhood was like. They don't live in any kind of comfort by any stretch of the imagination. And they've had terrible rains this year in the Zambezi Valley, which means an infiltration of frogs. So there's frogs everywhere. They're stuck on the mosquito net. They're on the handles of doors. If you drink three glasses of wine and take a sleeping pill, you too could wake up with a frog glued to your face.
So you don't recommend that?
Well, I don't recommend that. So what, you know, what happens is the snakes come in after the frogs, and there was a puff adder under my bed in my room, which are extremely toxic and kill more people than any other snake in Africa. And my father killed the snake on my insistence, breaking my mother's walking stick while he did so. And my mother was furious about the walking stick. And I think that they just, you know, and it's taken me, I've been home a month and I'm still jumpy, a cord on the ground, and I'm still jumping back. So I think that, you know, had I stayed there, I don't think my childhood would seem like such a distant sort of gauzy dream. But the fact that I left has definitely made it something that I could create into art.
I read somewhere that you thought that, in fact, writing from Wyoming, you were able to describe things in much greater detail. Can you talk about why that is?
I think because I missed Africa so much. I wrote from this incredible ache of missing the place, just being so homesick. I wrote primarily in the winter when in Wyoming you're under sort of 6 feet of snow and everything becomes a deadening. There's a sort of whiteness to the smells, the sounds, everything's sort of you know, dampened by the snow. And I miss the smells of Africa and the kind of chaos of it terribly, with a physical ache. And so in spite of what my mother thinks, I think I really wrote a love story for Africa and Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. My mother said, no, you didn't. You just wrote a very nasty book about your mother.
It also has to be sort of a slap in the face when you first go home after a long time in a different place to realize that you see it now with an entirely different eye than the one you had when you left it.
Well, I think that organically I attach into some places of it, very slip back into the smells, the sounds. It's an umbilical pull for me. I'm imprinted on that, you know. So that's not so difficult. What's harder is opening my mouth and hearing myself speak and realizing that my attitudes are quite different from what they would be had I stayed. And trying to wind back my sense of judgment and just be there. Because that's, I think, what I find hardest is, you know, we all find that hard. Judging is unattractive. It doesn't matter where you are, but particularly when you judge your sort of place of origin, I think you bring to it a certain sense of entitlement that you're entitled to judge it. I don't think that's true. So I think that's the greatest challenge for me, is just to sort of sit there and let it be itself around me.
Certainly, Don't Let's Go to the Dog Tonight is much more than a nasty book about your mother. But I also wonder if you had to be far away to write as truthfully about things that maybe you didn't want your girlfriends to know about your mom. She was a drinker, and you found out later that she was bipolar. Not always an easy person to be around. And we should say she lost three children when she was quite young.
You know, I think that, I wasn't expecting my girlfriends to read this book, for one thing. I wasn't expecting any. I was expecting my husband to read it, and maybe my children. That would be about it. And by the time the book came out, in my mind, I'd written such a compassionate, loving portrait of my mother that I was very surprised by her reaction, because in my sort of mind's eye, it had been quite different. And I think having put it on paper, it's not that it felt like someone else's story, but it felt slightly separate from me. I mean, for the first time, I didn't feel like I was carrying it around in some secret, horrible way that, you know, it was going to pop out some inopportune moment. Which isn't to say that I didn't deal with a lot of the sort of issues that it brought up afterwards, but at least I could see them to deal with them. So, I think on the whole, look, I think what the distance did, instead of making it easier to write about my mother, I think what it did was it showed me how extraordinary my childhood had been, what an extraordinary woman she was, how resourceful, and how credible to have survived losing three children and to have been this kind of great, complicated, compassionate, racist, hard-drinking, glamorous, difficult woman that she was. Distance gave me a clarity about how amazing she was. When you're there living it all the time, you don't realize it's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, I think there's a really telling section of the book where you write about the chapters of your mother when she had a guest over, and there would be, I guess, four chapters of what she would discuss. And you said, it sounded almost like the teenage you sort of telling us this story, that it's a lot sadder story if you haven't heard it 1,000 times, but you had. And I think what's interesting about that is that it also reveals that I think you're seeing yourself for the, you know, impudent teenager that we all are at some point in our lives. And I really got that, but maybe your mother didn't see it that way.
Well, you know, I think that, so hilariously, my mother and I, when I was recently home, mother and I went down to a safari camp about 10 minutes down the river from where they live. Dad had to dump us off and go back to the farm to deal with his fish. And so mum and I are there alone at the safari camp, and they poured these gin and tonics that were like Novocaine. I mean, you had one and your entire face went numb. And my mother had several, you know, one, and it was plenty for me. And anyway, we had supper, and mother sort of, you know, had several glasses of wine. So I eventually said to the guide, look, I'm off to bed. See you in the morning at 6 o'clock for our morning nature walk. So I arrived at 6 o'clock for my morning nature walk, and I said to the guide, I hope mum wasn't up too late after I went to bed. He said, no, actually, she was down quite quickly. And he had had to sort of carry her bodily to bed, which is not that uncommon. He then asked us later on the day to sign a book for him, by which time my father had returned from the farm. So he signed the book. I signed the book. My father signed the book, It's Not All True, Tim. And my mother wrote, unfortunately, most of it is, Nicola. And I think that was this like sort of reconciliation about who she is, which I think was such a gift in a way, because like, she's not going to change. She's in her 60s now. She's not going to quit drinking and go to AA. I mean, even if there was one, there's no psychologist within a million miles of where she lives, and she wouldn't see one even if there was. she is who she is. And I think accepting that instead, I mean, I think what was always so toxic growing up under that was that we always had to pretend it wasn't happening and that everything was fine, even when things were, you know, decidedly not fine. And so I think just being able to say, no, things aren't fine and that's fine too, has been a great gift of that book.
I know a lot of people reading the book through Western eyes look at your parents and say, why in the world didn't they leave? And in fact, they did for a couple of years and then they went back. What do you understand about why your parents chose, and I know that was their home, but why they chose to stay in Africa?
Well, I mean, I think you put your finger on it. It was their home. Mother had grown up in Kenya, and going to England for her was a nightmare. I mean, she was just culturally out of her depth. She was frightened. She was lonely. She was cold. And I think my dad was sort of bored. And they'd gone back because they'd lost a son in Rhodesia to meningitis. And I think the pain of that sort of, you know, I think when the going got tough, my parents literally got going and just sort of left to another place. But then when they got back to Rhodesia and they invested in this farm, I think they were too proud to ask for help to get to, you know, to ask someone to bail them out. They didn't want to go to England. And I think that the truth is that it's looking back, you see the series of disasters and you go, good Lord, that was a bad decision to stay where you were. But as they happen, you think, wow, how much worse can our luck get? We should stick it out. The worst must be over. You know, we've had war, we've lost three children, we've, you know, lost our farm. What else can possibly happen? Let's stick it out. And I think, actually, I can't really imagine them living anywhere else now. I mean, they're deeply sort of in love with that land. And the land sort of ingrained in them.
Alexandra Fuller is my guest. Her books are Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, Scribbling the Cat, and The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. She's in town to speak tonight at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Alexandra Fuller is my guest this hour. Her books include Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight and Scribbling the Cat, and last year's The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Paul, who asks, which authors inspired you to write about your own country's struggles? Americans, including me, know so few.
Well, okay, the books that inspired me to write about my own country's struggles were not written in Africa. I read a book called The Meadow by James Galvin, who's a writer out of Wyoming, and he writes about the love of land. It's the most extraordinarily beautiful book about attachment to land. And what it did was it helped me see the situation in Zimbabwe without judgment. That what if we take away the sticky issue of race and just say that everyone loves land, that there's, that is at the bottom of everything, this passion for this resource. And if you looked at it like that, it kind of took the barbs off it and let me write about my childhood in a way that I didn't feel attached to the judgment that was going to come out of it. There was also a beautiful book by Michael Ondaatje, the Canadian author who's wrote about, he's from Sri Lanka, who wrote a book called Running in the Family about his parents. And, you know, his dad was this sort of horrendous boozer and sort of rampaged all over Sri Lanka, behaving incredibly badly. But he wrote with such tenderness about his family and again, lack of judgment. I didn't look at my fellow writers for inspiration. However, there are plenty to go to. I would suggest Alexander Calangoni, Echoing Silences. It's an almost unknown book, but he writes about writing about the resistance. He was a liberation struggle during the Rhodesian War, a soldier on the other side from K. And actually, it was reading his book. I'd picked it up in the airport in Johannesburg, and I'd been on book tour in South Africa, and I flew back and read it and just sort of stayed glued to my seat, weeping for 18 hours, rereading it. It's a short book. I think I read it four times between Johannesburg and Atlanta. And what struck me wasn't that his story sounded so foreign to me. It was that it sounded exactly like the stories I had heard told by white Rhodesian soldiers. Mm-hmm. And so that really inspired me.
Do you feel fully African?
Do you know, I used to insist on being an African. I get really upset in interviews or, you know, Q&As of people, I don't know, challenged my Africanness. I'd hop up and down and insist, of course, I was African. Such a load of rubbish. I don't know what I am. And it doesn't matter. I mean, of course, it influenced who I am. Of course, I honor the place I come from. That is true. But I've also fallen in love with Wyoming desperately and written a book about that. And in a way, I think writing about a place is kind of a passport to that place. If you truly take it from a place of love and compassion. So I like to tell people in Wyoming who get fed up with me ranting and raving about Wyoming politics and, you know, how dare I, in my silly accent, tell them what to do because they've been doing it just fine for four generations. And I say, well, good, if you're here for four generations, then yours is an arranged marriage. But for me, this is a love marriage. And I feel just as attached to Wyoming as I do to, you know, for example, Zambia. But I don't know why it would end there. Why can't I have an attachment for the globe? Cindy Sheehan was being interviewed once, you know, the peace activist, and someone asked her if she was a patriot. She was on BBC radio with Owen Bennett-Jones. I'll never forget this. And she said, no, she wasn't a patriot. She was a matriot. And that made Owen Bennett-Jones squeak. He sounded so alarmed. He said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, a patriot, you know, believes that the rights of their countrymen take supremacy. She said, I don't believe that. I believe the rights of all people are supreme, that all children should be protected. And I remember exactly where I was when I heard that interview, and I thought that is something to embrace, to be a matriot, not a patriot, not to stitch yourself down to one identity. I think if you say I'm African, that excludes the other 999 things I could possibly be. Wouldn't I rather be the 999 other things and maybe be a little less African?
How different was it to take on a book, I guess for the first time when you were telling Colton Bryant's story, that even your novels were really your story? Suddenly you had to shift your focus entirely.
I felt like I had to learn a whole new language for one thing, because in case discerning listeners haven't noticed, I don't exactly have a Wyoming twang. And so what really struck me was the way Wyoming speaks in silences. You go into an interview, you literally ask a question, and the wind blows for 5 minutes. Maybe someone spits. That's your answer. And I was writing about a 25-year-old boy who was killed in a rig accident, entirely preventable. He was one of six roughnecks killed in 18 months just on this one particular, four roughnecks killed in 18 months on this one particular oil patch. I was up in Montana on a different assignment, really worrying about how to tell this boy's story, by which time I've, of course, completely fallen in love with his father, this kind of taciturn cowboy who's a second-generation oil rig worker. And I'd fallen in love with his best friend, Jake Wigginton. But I still wasn't sure, how do I tell this story? How do I get the words right? And I was listening to Ira Glass's This American Life, which I'm completely addicted to.
That's an amazing show.
Yeah. And he was doing a thing on incarceration, a big segment on incarceration, and he was interviewing Breyten Breytenbach, the great South African poet, who talked about being incarcerated during apartheid in Pretoria, in what they called Beverly Hills, which was the prison where they actually hanged political activists. And in the time that he was imprisoned there, the 2 years that he was there, on average, someone was hanged every 2 to 3 days. And these people were kept in isolated confinement. The prisoners were unable to talk to one another. But you know, the sound that they could hear all the time was that ka-clang, you know, of the person being hanged once every 2 or 3 days. So the men would communicate by singing. Breiten Breitenbach is an Afrikaner. He's a white Afrikaans. But a lot of the people who were incarcerated were Zulu or Xhosa. And they would sing to one another as their form of communication, the desire to tell stories, I think, and to have camaraderie. But the night before someone was hanged, only the condemned man would sing. And Breiten Breitenbach talked about how the quality of listening in the whole prison changed, how you could feel people aching to hear the last words of that condemned man. And I'm sitting up in northern Montana all alone in this tiny bed and breakfast listening to Breiten Breitenbach, who, you know, whose words I felt tuned into. I know that accent. I know that attitude. Tears streaming down my face and realizing that to write Colton H. Bryant's story, it wasn't the talking that needed to change, but the quality of my listening.
Do you listen the same way in every exchange? I mean, I know that you also do some journalism work. It's got to be a different process, or maybe not.
How do you mean?
Well, when you're telling a story that you will sort of get your feet really rooted into from the very beginning and know that you're going to follow over the course of the passage of time, as opposed to something that sort of is made for instant consumption and then to be finished.
Oh, I never do anything for instant consumption. I mean, I don't know what that would feel like. I wish I could. That sounds lovely.
So you can't let go of a story
ever.
After you've told it?
No, and I don't start a story thinking, well, I have occasionally, but I've now learned. I mean, there's no... That for me is no story that you go into and just go, well, I'm not going to be here for the long haul, because I really certainly wasn't expecting to write The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. I think I've learned to take every exchange as something that could matter and that does matter.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk to David in Fort Worth. Hello, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
She just compared Wyoming I'm comparing in my mind Wyoming with Africa, and I'm wondering if she does the same thing, because I know that what I see on TV is all I know about Africa, but what I've seen in Wyoming is very, very beautiful. Can you comment on that? I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
You know, I think the wide open spaces and certainly the beauty, but there's a quality in the people that's so similar. I think that when I was writing about Colton H. Bryant, what really struck me speaking to his father is that Colton's father and my father could have been the same person, sort of taciturn and stoic and don't say much at all. And you better be paying attention when he does talk, because it's probably going to be worth something. Colton's best friend, Jake, you know, these are boys. Colton was 25 when he was killed. So when I met Jake, Jake was 24. And I walked into his cabin to interview him for the first time and opened the door. And Jake's son, Wyatt, was playing with a gun on the floor. It was a plastic gun. But, you know, growing up in a civil war, I'm a little bit touchy about this stuff. So I sort of fling my arms in the air and I say, "Don't shoot." And Jake looks over and he goes, "That's right, Wyatt. Don't shoot it. Remember, you shoot it, you got to eat it." And it just reminded me so much of the people I grew up with. This incredible kind of, you know, this humor, very, you know, kind of mordant humor, extremely hospitable, but also close-minded to the point of self-destruction. You know, they're not a fan of hippies. They did not like Brokeback Mountain in Wyoming. The response to that was, well, that must have been some ugly sheep. There was... You know, but also this, you know, being tied to the land in that particular way, because it is a beautiful, difficult place. It's land that feels to me, Alan Paton, who wrote Cry the Beloved Country, talks about land, you know, being the sort of place that if you take care of it, it will take care of you. Treat it with disrespect and you'll end up under about 6 feet of it in short order. Wyoming and where I come from feel very similar in that way.
Do you think that being drawn to a beautiful and difficult place is a factor of where and how and when you grew up, or is that just something that's maybe within your genes if you think about your parents and what they chose to embrace in their lives?
I couldn't separate out the two if I tried now. I also couldn't imagine living in a place that didn't present me with conflict. And I can't decide whether I'm drawn to it or it's drawn to me. I don't think it much matters.
Well, you know, you hear sometimes about children who have lived through abusive parenting, and they get to a place where the most normal thing feels like chaos. And, and I wonder if you can relate to that.
Oh, I think everyone who, every now and again, I'll meet with in New York, for example, with a group of friends from different parts of Africa and Nigeria and all the rest of it. We'll be sitting around the table, and we're, you know, I'm 40 now, but we're various ages, most of us sort of 40 and younger. Looking around, not one of us has gotten out of our childhood without losing at least one sibling, if not more. Most of us have seen some kind of violence in the form of war. And most of us will end up talking about the tolerance we have for chaos to the point that I think it can become something that you're so used to you don't notice it. And in fact, one of the greatest, I think, gifts of getting older is surrendering to a more tranquil life, not needing to go in search of the... I don't have to have chaos surrounding me in order to feel alive. My husband would argue, I have 6 horses, 3 dogs, 2 cats, 3 children, and that feels like just the right level of chaos. But, you know, for me, compared to real chaos, that's just sort of background noise.
Well, having lost 3 siblings, 2 of whom you actually knew, you write about the fact that when you were a kid, you had this sense that you were special and lucky to be alive. Mm. I can't imagine what that must feel like for a child as young as you were when you first heard the story of your brother who had died.
You know, I think it's something that isn't so well understood and explored, which is what happens to surviving siblings who, if one or more child is lost in the family. And I've spoken to other people who have this experience. It becomes something you can't talk about because it's so painful for your parents. So the most important thing in your psyche is the one thing you cannot ask your parents about. And your parents' friends certainly similarly touchy about it. They don't really want to go into it. Perhaps they don't know about it all that well. So it's something that's shrouded in secrecy. If you're lucky, a surviving sibling will talk to you about it. So my sister and I have talked about it, but not much, not as much as you would think. And I think that it, for me, it gave me a sense of responsibility to absolutely feel every moment, to live fully and to live as if I was living the lives for 3 people who didn't make it. I think that's not true of all siblings who survive. I think my sister, if anything, sort of shut herself down and off. It's as, almost as if she's afraid to feel or live too much, as if the sort of falling in love with life would be too painful. And I can see that both ways would be valid.
Alexandra Fuller has been my guest this hour. Her books include Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, Scribbling the Cat, and The Legend of Colton H. Bryant. She will be speaking tonight at Arts and Letters Live in Dallas at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can learn about that at dallasmuseumofart.org. Alexandra, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.